Welcome to another broadcast of Crime Beat with Ron Chepsik, the show that puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Crime Beat brings you a lineup of dynamic and provocative guests who allow you to experience their lives and learn more about crime. Al Proffitt, the noted crime documentarian, says, quote, Crime Beat is the best show of its kind for the thinking listener, both entertaining and educational. Let me introduce the host of Crime Beat. A native of Thunder Bay, Canada, Ron Chepsik is an award-winning author, documentary producer and director, publisher and screenwriter. He's the author of more than 36 books and 4,000 published magazine, newspaper, and internet articles. Ron is a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, was a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series, and has worked as an instructor in UCLA's Extension Journalism program. Four of Ron's books and several of his screenplays have been optioned for movies. For more information, visit ronchepsik.com. Given his publications, extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Here he is, your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott, for that nice introduction. Good evening, world, wherever you are tonight. Well, Scott, yeah, I know you're excited. We finally got our speaker. He's Mike Johnson.
Yeah.
I know you'll love this. He's a election denier. He's denies climate change, and he's a fierce opponent of LGBTQ rights. In fact, he said that if it was allowed, he thinks that people would want to start marrying animals.
I could say something, but I won't. Yeah. How encouraging that we've got a nutbag as the Speaker of the House. Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the extreme right, won. You know, they got a MAGA guy in the speakership, so it's going to be interesting to see how he works with Democrats on that. But anyways, we've got a real interesting show tonight. I've got a personal connection to this story here. We're welcoming Dan Lawton, and we're going to be discussing his book, Above the Ground, A True Story of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Here's the story. On Sunday, November 26, 1978, two IRA gunmen, as Irish Republican Army gunmen, kicked in the front door at 8 Evelyn Gardens in Belfast, Northern Ireland, which was the home of May's prison official, Albert Miles. They then executed Miles in front of his horrified family and disappeared into the night in 1983 after the longest and most publicized trial in the country's history. 24-year-old Catholic taxicab driver Kevin Barry Art was convicted and sentenced to life for Miles' murder. On his way to the maze, Art prayed for an opportunity to escape. 6 weeks later, his prayers were answered when he made a daring and dramatic escape, fleeing to California and going underground. That prison escape involved 38 other prisoners. Imagine that, 38 prisoners escaped. For decades, the British government, aided by the U.S. Department of State and FBI, evidently sought while he managed to stay steps ahead of his pursuers. Tonight, Crime Beat will discuss with Dan Lawton about one of the darkest periods in Northern Ireland's history. We're highlighting themes of injustice, perseverance, and hope through Kevin Art's escape and struggle. It's going to be an exciting show. We will be with Dan Lawton shortly, but first take care of business. Acknowledgements to the people are helping to make Crime Beat one of the most popular shows on the internet. We're thrilled and delighted that we've had positive comments and thumbs up about our show. We're in more than 160 countries around the world that listen to our broadcasts, and we've had more than 80 million downloads of our archive show since the show's inception in 2011. Shows are free and downloadable. You miss a live show, you go to the artistfirst.com website to listen to it. You can take our shows and post them on the web on any website. I'd like to thank our sponsor, CG Media Books, for making our show possible. And thanks to the production people, the Artist First Radio Network, and particularly the Ryan Brothers, for allowing us to use their great music for our theme song. It's got the beat to crime written all over it. Just look at the mailbag for this week. Continue to get mail from all over the world. Some comments are long, so we edit them for length. This email is from Anonymous. He doesn't want to use your name. He writes, Anonymous writes, amazing story. The FBI were caught with their pants down and paid the price. He's referring to our discussion last week with Briar Lee Mitchell about his book, Forensic Analysis of the 1988 FBI Firefight. It was devastating to the FBI. Right, Scott? I mean, they were caught really with their pants down in terms of firepower.
Yeah, they were outgunned, and it's great. You guys might remember Briar Lee Mitchell. She had a show on our network for almost 2 years. She's very knowledgeable about what she does, and she brought that to light in the last week's program. You should check it out.
Yeah, really interesting on that. And I didn't know that the SWAT team concept came out of that incident.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
The SWAT team developed, which was really quite interesting.
That's a great trivia question. When did SWAT teams begin? Well, Breyer could answer that.
1986 with the FBI firefight. Well, we encourage you to continue emailing with your comments and suggestions. You can do that at crimeb123@yahoo.com. That's crimeb123@yahoo.com. Tell us if you don't want to use your name, no problem. So what have you been up to? Just go to the strategicmurderbooks.com website. We have several books coming out on crime, which may interest you. We offer affordable advertising opportunities for sponsors and authors. We have several packages to meet your budget. Contact us again at crimeb123@yahoo.com. Then look at next week's show. The hits keep coming. November 2nd, 2023. We will have Douglas Thompson from England and Mike Rothmiller from the U.S. to discuss their book, Frank Sinatra and the Mafia Murders. It's going to be really interesting. This is a really hot-selling book. And, of course, the topic is always interesting. Frank Sinatra and the Mafia. Now, let's look at the news for this week. We call this a Rap Sheet part of our program. Rap Sheet features a couple of items of news that caught our attention and you might have missed. This first one is about who else? Donald Trump. And, of course, he was fined by the judge recently in his New York Civil Trial because the social media posts disparaging one of his staffers remained visible for weeks. New York Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron had ordered Trump on October 3rd not to criticize his staff and to delete the post that showed his clerk, Allison Greenfield, with Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and accused her of being his girlfriend, which was, of course, ridiculous, but the post remained visible for weeks. The dispute illustrated how judges could potentially penalize Trump even before verdicts in the various civil and criminal cases pending against him. U.S. District Judge Tanya Shutkin has also ordered Trump not to criticize prosecutors, court staff, or witnesses in his federal trial on charges he conspired to overturn the 2020 election. Trump asked Shutkin on Friday, or last Friday, to suspend her order while he appeals his decision. Engoron called Truth Social's retention of the post, quote, a blatant violation of his limits of gag order. Before the post was removed, Trump's campaign sent it out as an email to his supporters. Christopher Kice, one of Trump's lawyers, said the email was sent to 25,800 recipients and opened by about 6,700. About 3,700 people viewed the post on Trump's campaign website, Kice said. This is really interesting. I saw today that the ACLU is defending Trump on this case. They said that the judge overstepped his bounds.
Really? I did not hear that.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't get a chance to see what they were arguing.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, but you only had 25,800 recipients of his email. That's not a lot of emails.
Yeah, his influence is waning.
Yeah, I think so on that then. And on the topic of Make America Great Again, we have Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida. And of course, he isn't happy about the way Capitol Hill chaos he orchestrated is developing. The 17 days after he and seven other hardliners voted to boot Kevin McCarthy from the speakership, Gates' preferred replacement, Reverend Jim Jordan, got the same treatment, and scores of Republicans voted secretly to kick him off the ticket on Friday. Gates fumed about the outcome online, conveniently blaming it on the swamp. Quote, the most popular Republican in Congress was just knifed in an anonymous vote in a secret closed-door meeting in the basement of the Capitol. Gates wrote in a post to X, formerly known as Twitter, quote, this is swamp at work on that. You know, these people lie all the time, you know, Jordan's not very popular. He had 68 people vote against him for the speakership.
Yeah, all of the wrestlers he was supposed to be coaching, they all would have voted against him.
Yeah, on that then. But he got his way. You know, the extreme right wing got the speakership on that then. Well, that's it for the Rap Sheet. Therefore, before we continue our broadcast, we're going to have a conversation with Dan Lawton. Let's take a station identification break. Good.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. This is episode number 636. Send us your questions and comments to crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
636, I can really count that high. Wow, that's great. Well, listeners, Crime Beat feature guest this evening is Dan Lawton. We'll be discussing his book, Above the Ground, A True Story of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Welcome to the show, Dan Lawton.
Ron and Scott, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're in California, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, on that end. Yeah, I got, you know, we were talking with you before the show, and I was saying I had a personal connection to this story. I was in Northern Ireland. I was in Ireland when Art was being interrogated by the investigators in Northern Ireland, and I was in Ireland for about 1982, and I came about 3 or 4 months after Bobby Sands committed suicide in prison, and it was really a tense time on that. So what's your connection to that part of the world?
Well, I met Kevin Barry Art, the subject of Above the Ground, in 1992. I was a young lawyer in San Diego, and he'd been recently arrested by the FBI, was wanted by the British government for murder and for escaping the Mays prison, which he had escaped in 1983. And he had a public defender at that time named Mark Geller, who spoke to me and explained that he was going to be leaving the case because the federal prosecutors were transferring Mr. Art up to San Francisco and planning to have an extradition trial there. But he knew that the law firm that I worked for at that time did asylum cases for refugees on a pro bono basis, and he suggested that I go and visit Kevin Barry Art in the jail, which I did. And I listened to his story, and that was the beginning of my involvement with him.
Right. When did you decide that his story is worth a book and that you would be the one that would do it?
Maybe around the year 1995 or later. I can't pinpoint the exact date on which a light bulb went on and a bubble over my head appeared and it said, hey, this is a great idea for a book. But I did decide that I was the one to write the story, or I should be the one to write the story. And really that was delusional on my part, because I had never written a book before. I thought I knew how to write, but the sort of writing that I did was all legal writing intended for courts, not what I would call good writing for a general audience. But the power of that delusion, if you will, propelled me forward, and eventually I got the opportunity to write this story.
Right. Well, I have to hand it to you. You stuck it out for like 16 months, right, to write it?
I took a sabbatical from my law practice for 16 months. I laid off, you know, everybody that worked for me. I told them what I was doing and explained that I had a limited window of time in which to complete this book, or else the rights would revert back to Kevin Barry Art, and I would lose, you know, the window would close, and I would lose the chance to do it unless I got going on it. And a couple of planets lined up for me in my law practice, and I was able to take 16 months of full time to devote to the research and writing of Above the Ground.
Right. Well, it's a great book, and fascinating subject. Did you have much problem getting a publisher?
I don't know if I have enough sample size to compare, you know, whether I had a bigger or a lesser problem in finding a publisher than some other writers. I was lucky to have a terrific agent. His name was Chip McGregor, and we queried some publishers, and in the end there were three publishers who bid on it, and I chose a publisher that I thought was the very best one, and that was, of course, Wild Blue Press.
Right. I've published two books with them as well, and they're very good. You know, a true crime on that. So you had to sit down with him. What was Mr. Art like?
In person, Kevin Barry Art has always been These are the adjectives I'd use to answer your question. Cheerful, optimistic, very funny, genuine, charming, courteous, and a nice man, and really the opposite of everything that the British government and federal prosecutors in our U.S. Attorney's Office would have you believe that he is.
So you had no doubts that he was innocent?
I would say this, Ron. I would say when I first met with him in that jail cell in the MCC in downtown San Diego in 1992, he was wary with me, but he was very open with me. And he spun a tale of his life and of his escape from Northern Ireland and his conviction that sounded fantastical and, you know, frankly, improbable to me and implausible as well. And, you know, mind you, I'm trained as a lawyer, and to be somewhat skeptical of some of the things that your clients tell you sometimes. So I would say I walked out of the jail that night agnostic as to whether he was innocent or guilty of the murder of Albert Miles. What I knew was that he was an Irishman on the run from the British government, and that was good enough for me. But by 1995, by which time his legal team had done a tremendous volume of investigation, been over to Northern Ireland, interviewed witnesses, pulled records, pulled transcripts, police documents, it became clear as time passed that everything he said that seemed really far-fetched or implausible or crazy even was verifiable and true, you know, in some cases, according to police records. And his lawyer at the time, Jim Brosnahan, you know, said to me after we got back from a trip to Belfast in 1995, you know, in his peculiar way of speaking, he said, "Dan, I think he might actually be innocent. I think maybe he didn't do this murder." And
He claimed that, you know, he adamantly claimed that he was innocent. You know, he's never wavered in that conclusion about his case.
That's true, except for the unfortunate fact of his confession.
That was allegedly coerced,
It was definitely coerced. It was coerced.
And there's plenty of evidence of that. I mean, the brutality of the guards and the way they treated, Catholic prisoners is pretty well documented on that, because I remember hearing stories myself when I was in Northern Ireland and I was in Belfast, you know, about that. On that. So what was the most difficult part of doing the book for you as a novice writer?
The first obstacle I had, or problem that I had, as you point out, is I had never done this before. I was really coming at it as a novice, with a delusion that I could do it.
Right.
And I thought what I had to do was I had to get in contact with really successful writers and form a little kitchen cabinet, if you will, or, you know, a circle of whoever would talk to me and answer my questions, give me counsel about what I was doing, maybe point me in the right direction, save me some time. And to my pleasant surprise, I found that almost every one of them, and I cold called or cold emailed all of them because I didn't have any relationships with any of them, dropped what they were doing, were generous of spirit and time and counsel, and helped me.
Right.
With no expectation of anything in return. So Patrick Radden Keefe, you know, the great writer of The New Yorker, who also the author of Say Nothing. Joseph Wambaugh, who wrote all those great novels.
Joseph Wambaugh reading your stuff?
About the LAPD. He helped me, and he didn't know me from Adam. Seamus Dean, the late Seamus Dean of Ireland, a great historian and novelist in his own right.
Right.
You know, they all helped me, and I went about it in the best way that I knew how. I put up whiteboards all over the place. I felt, you know, I had to do that. I'm visual. I got my hands on, you know, the first time I walked into a conference room at Morrison & Foerster in San Francisco and I saw the volume of their file, it, you know, took up 125 banker's boxes.
Oh, wow.
And for a moment, I stood there and I went, where do I begin? You know, how am I going to digest all this, organize it, and be able to mine it for the facts that I need to tell the story? Getting the cooperation of the British government, the police service of Northern Ireland, the prison service, to give me interviews and give me documents, that was hard because the answer a lot of the time was no, if you got an answer at all.
Right.
Getting IRA men to sit down was a little bit less hard, but
right.
still hard.
Right.
So there were some hard aspects to it, but I don't, you know, lest your audience get the wrong idea, you know, what a gift it was, what a great experience it was for me to take a break from the grind of law practice, and it can be a grind sometimes, to work on doing, you know, telling a story that I thought was unique. That was a great blessing in my life to be able to do that.
Right. How, did your law background help you as a writer in writing the book?
I think litigation practice teaches you how to write, I hope, in a punchy way, to be concise, to organize a mass of data that's just, you know, in some cases very enormous, and boil it down to a few salient facts that really matter to the story. I think it was good preparation, yeah.
On that then. And how long did you talk to Mr. Art?
You know, I can't quantify the hundreds of hours over the years that I've spent talking to him, asking him questions.
Did you take any conversations? Did you have, or did you take notes?
I took notes throughout, and, you know, I started interviewing him, I mean, starting in 1992 when I first met him, and I didn't stop after that for 8 years while I was part of his legal team. I left his legal team in the year 2000, and then when I got the rights in 2016, I started doing some of the research, but I didn't really sit down with him again until 2018. He was committed under the terms of our contract to give me at least 4 hours a week of interviews. And he has a family with teenage kids, and I didn't want to interfere with his family life. But when I needed, you know, another interview with him, I would fly up to San Francisco where he lives, and he would meet me, and we would sit down. And he always answered my questions very freely and openly.
It would seem that the information you gathered would be almost overwhelming. You know, talking about the boxes, the records, plus the interview notes and all that sort of stuff. Was that a challenge in trying to organize that material and keep it coherent?
It was a challenge, Ron, but, you know, I had some wonderful help. And the people at Morrison & Forster in the copy center there, they asked me how I would like, you know, this 125 boxes worth of court records and interview notes and all the maps, all the rest of it. How would I like it, you know, reproduced? And I said, well, can you scan it and make it word searchable? And they immediately said yes.
Oh,
and I said, I said, how long will that take? And they said, oh, we need 2 or 3 weeks. And they did it, and I got a CD-ROM that was word searchable. You know, now that saved me a tremendous amount of time. But I printed out a lot of material, organized it into binders, all the court records, you know, the 10-month trial, or nearly 10-month trial in Belfast. You know, I turned every page, and but, you know, boiling it down, and you know this because you're a writer yourself, and you write about true crime, there's a lot of volume, and you've got to get the reader to stick with you. And part of doing that, I think, is boiling down to the essentials.
Right, and thinking story, right? What is a story?
Yeah.
You know,
and
all that stuff you collected.
Well, I mean, speaking of that, I have here in front of me a log of... I called it a word count table. You know, I couldn't think of a better way to measure my output when I was working on this manuscript than to count the words I had written each week. So I did that. And I finished the first draft of the manuscript August 2019, and it was 393,929 words.
Uh-oh.
And that's way too long. That's about four times longer than publishers would want. So I started a process of cutting and editing, you know, over time, and it wound up being about 105,000 words. So most of it wound up on the cutting room floor. The process of doing that was another, you know, education for me as a first-time writer. And I consulted, again, my little circle of successful writers and said, look, what do? Do you cut whole sections, or do you go through each chapter and lean up each chapter until you get it down? You know, what do you do? That was a process, and that was an education for me.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners are wannabe writers, or there are writers in true crime. You know, they love the subject. Well, what advice would you give, given the vast experience you gained from writing this book? What advice would you give to more novice writers?
I would say, you know, like anything else, if you wanted to know how to do carpentry, or how to lay your own plumbing, and right. you know, whatever that would be, sail a boat around the world, go and find some people that have done it at a high level. Find that guy that's been there and done it, and done it really well.
Right.
See if you can get in front of that person, or if you can't get in front of him, start a correspondence with him, and you know, ask the questions that you're afraid to ask, the questions that you feel like are dumb. You know, I had some questions at the beginning of my little journey. One of them was, what is the point of view that I'm writing from? Am I writing third person omniscient? Am I writing from a first person standpoint because I was involved in this case for a period of time, or what? Another question I had was, as an American, can I write convincingly about the Troubles, you know, or yeah. is that a subject that's so beyond my grasp that no matter how much reading and study I do, I'm never going to be able to write about it in a way that the audience will accept. And
right.
I got good advice on those topics from these writers. So, you know, you think you have a great story, and a lot of people think they have a great story, and a lot of people have a great story. But soak up as much counsel as you can along the way. And it's out there, and it's out there for you. And I found that the writers I've met
right.
are really nice people, and often nicer people than, you know, in
right.
in the law world.
Right.
I'm sorry to say.
That's interesting. You mentioned the Troubles, and your subtitle is A True Story of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Can you briefly just tell us what the Troubles are for the audience when it comes to Ireland and its politics?
Well, the Troubles were a war and a social conflict that occurred in Northern Ireland for 30 years, roughly over a 30-year span from 1968 to 1998, when the Troubles are thought to have ended with the Good Friday Agreement, which was created with the great help of U.S. Senator George Mitchell, who helped to bring the parties together and hammer out the agreement. But there was a guerrilla revolutionary army, the Irish Republican Army, which you mentioned at the top of the show, that wanted to drive the British government out of Northern Ireland and to unify all the counties of Ireland, the northern six counties, the southern 26 counties, under the Irish tricolor flag, and unify the country. And they were a violent and ruthless organization. On the other side, you had the British police, the RUC, Royal Ulster Constabulary, and the British Army backing them up. And then a third party, which was loyalist paramilitary groups, and there were several of them that were sort of counterparts to the IRA or opposite numbers of the IRA, and they were quite violent also. And their viewpoint was that Northern Ireland was and always should remain a part of Great Britain. A unified Ireland, you know, no way. We're never going to agree to that. About 3,700 people were killed, you know, tens of thousands injured, and, you know, many other forms of terrible suffering inflicted on all three of those sides by the others.
Right. On that then. And Kevin Barryart was caught up in it, and we're going to be discussing his story. First, we're going to take a break. This will conclude the first part of our show tonight. Scott, let's take a break. We're going to do commercials, and we'll be back shortly.
Hi, I'm James Baller of Artist First Radio, and I would like to tell you about a fascinating new book from Crime Beat's Ron Chepsik and co-author Mike Rowe. It's titled Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy Kingpin, and it's published by Strategic Media Books. The book is a historical account of Theodore Teddy Rowe, who courageously fought the Chicago Mafia, more commonly known as the Outfit, for control of the lucrative policy racket in the Windy City. Policy, often called the numbers, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery, played mostly in poor and working-class neighborhoods in the United States. In policy, a better attempts to pick three digits to match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. For decades, policy had been a staple in the black community, but when the white mob flexed its power in the late 1940s, many policy kings knuckled under the pressure. Not Teddy Roe. Roe famously told mob bosses that he'd rather die than give up control of his operation. Robin Hood of the Hood chronicles an exciting chapter of Chicago history. Go to the Kindle store at Amazon and buy it for just $2.99. For information about this book and other titles, please go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts are podcasts. Pick them up at artistfirst.com. Back to your host, Ron Chepson.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Dan Lawton, and we're having a fascinating discussion about his book, Above the Law, A True Story of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It's the story of Kevin Barry Art, who's actually an innocent man, but he was caught up in the troubles back in the 70s, and he's been in the U.S. for almost 40 years, or more than 40 years now, on that. And the book is available everywhere. Right, Dan?
Right, it's available on Amazon, and it's also available directly via Wild Blue Press's website, Wild Blue Press being the publisher. You can get it in hardcover, paperback, or in Kindle version
And there's an audiobook, right?
Yeah, there's a plan for an audiobook, and I don't believe production is complete on that yet, so audiobook is not yet available, but it will be.
That's interesting. Is he going to have is the narrator going to have a Northern Ireland accent?
I really hope that the narrator has that in his wheelhouse of dialects, because there's a lot of dialogue that is spoken by Belfast native speakers in this book.
Yeah. I remember I was in the Public Records Office of Northern Ireland, and there was another worker there, and he was getting me some records, and he talked to me for 10 minutes, and I didn't understand a word he said, and he was speaking English.
in that position, yeah.
Yeah, he was speaking with a northern, with a Protestant accent, mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand anything he said on that sort of stuff. But you're active on social media?
I don't know about active. I've got a Twitter page, and I put blog posts there, and photographs, and stuff like that. But I'm not as active as I should be on social media, and I'm sure my publisher... Wild Blue wishes I was more active.
Yeah,
so Wild Blue. I mean, Steve, Mike, Stephanie, Jasmine. Yeah. If you're listening, I promise to be better on social media.
Yeah, Facebook. I would. That's one thing that you got to be active on, because that's a major way of getting a word out about your books. On that, but you've got a website above the. Law book.
Above the ground book.com. Yeah, there are photographs there. There's video. There's a lot of material on there. There's a synopsis, and I hope if your audience is interested, they'll go to that website. It's abovethegroundbook.com, and check it out. There are links there to Amazon's webpage and to Wild Blue Press too.
Right, on that sort of stuff. Can we see you in action on YouTube? Any video of you?
I don't think there's any video of me. Boy, this is getting embarrassing. You're asking me all these questions about it, and I'm learning all this stuff I'm not doing. I would say no, there is some video on that website. It's not of me, but I hope there will be some of that. We're doing an event at... the Notre Dame Law School on November 17th. Possibly that'll be videotaped, and we'll put the video up. We'll be doing another event at USC at some point in the near future. So there'll be some chances for that.
Right, on that. Then you got to have a YouTube channel. That's what they say. I haven't got one yet, but they say you got to get one on that then. So anyways, getting back to our discussion, let's talk about the actual crime. We had a gentleman... his name was Miles, and it was 1978, and two guys showed up at his house and just killed him in front of his family. Who was this guy?
Albert Miles was the deputy governor of the Mays Prison at the time being the main prison where the British government kept IRA men as prisoners. And the word governor equates in American usage to warden. So the warden of that prison, Stanley Hilditch, was known as the governor of the prisoner. His title was governor. Albert Miles was his second in charge, deputy governor of that prison. And in that role, he was responsible for, you know, supervising and keeping under control these hundreds of IRA prisoners who, during the late 70s, were engaged in severe protest against the conditions in the Mays prison and the British government's recently enacted policy of criminalization, which changed their treatment from what it had been before, which was basically as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention, to common criminals who, you know, had to wear prison-issued uniforms and perform work. And the IRA men took that as, they found that unacceptable. They viewed themselves as prisoners in a war, prisoners of war. And so they started a protest which escalated in really ugly ways, and the guards and prisoners really became at odds. And the war between the IRA and the British government really played out in substantial part inside the walls of that prison. Right. And the IRA took exception to the way its men were being treated on the inside, and they started going after prison officials on the outside, in their homes, you know, out in public, off the shift. And Albert Miles was a victim of that campaign, and he was shot and killed that night, November 26, 1978, in his home in Evelyn Gardens in Belfast, in front of his wife and his son.
I'm amazed he never had better security.
Well, you know, he was advised to, you know, improve security, maybe not live in that neighborhood. It was thought to be an unsafe neighborhood. And he poo-pooed that. You know, he felt like he didn't need that. He didn't want it. And, you know, would he have survived, you know, anyway if he'd had it? There's no way of knowing. But his son, Alan, is still alive today. He's about 66 years of age, and just by coincidence with your podcast, I'm going to be meeting with him in New York City next weekend. We're going to have dinner, get together. He's bringing his son, Harry. We're going to talk about the book and whatever's on his mind.
He's never met Kevin Art, right?
He's never met him. They have met on Zoom. We had a Zoom call, the three of us, a couple of years ago. It was the first time either one of them had laid eyes on each other. They'd exchanged some emails. But Alan Miles really, to this day, would love to meet Kevin Berry Art in person. And I really wish Kevin was going to be with us in New York and getting together with us.
What's his view of the altered innocence of Mr. Art?
His view, I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the question.
What's his view of the guilt or innocence of Mr. Art, of Kevin Art?
Oh, yeah. I think he believes 80% that Kevin Berry Art is innocent. And he's got some very strong feelings about what happened. How could you not, being the son of your dad and watching your dad get shot down in cold blood in front of you? He did see and make eye contact with the shooters that night, and the two gunmen were not wearing masks or hoods, so he got a good look at their faces. And I remember the first time I showed him a photograph of Kevin Berry Art, and I held my breath a little bit when I did it, and he instantly said, not him, he wasn't there that night.
Oh, wow. Wow, on that. Yeah, so... what was Kevin Berry Art doing at that time? He was a taxi driver, right? And so how did he get caught up with being fingered for the killings?
Well, at the time, Kevin Berry Art was 19 years of age, and this would be in 1978, and he was living in the New Lodge, which was a heavily Catholic and Republican part of West Belfast. And on that night, at that moment, he was with the family of his girlfriend, whose house he lived in at the time. He had left home at age 15, and His girlfriend's name was Lorraine Keenan, and they lived in New Lodge, and they invited him to move in with them, and he did. And they were watching television. At some point, he went out, you know, to a pub. Lorraine Keenan testified at his trial and gave an alibi or gave testimony that would furnish an alibi. And by that time, of course, she and Kevin Barriard had broken up, and Kevin had impregnated and married another woman, which did not endear her at all to Lorraine Keenan or her family. But she came all the way from England to testify at the trial and say, look, he was with me that night. The police, you know, pulled in a group of suspects shortly after the shooting. His name wound up on the list. They interrogated him at Castlereagh Interrogation Center for the better part of 5 days, and they released him. And after that, shortly after that, a detective with the RUC, whose name was George Fife, who was a friend of Kevin's birth father, sat down with Kevin and his dad and said, look, we know you didn't do this, but the problem is you're associating with all the wrong people. You know, you need to break up with Lorraine Keenan. You need to stop driving the taxi for Ace. You need to move to a different part of town.
Was Ardent Republican?
I would say by that time, his sympathies were definitely on the Republican side. He had witnessed firsthand the brutality of, you know, British Army troops, experienced the poor treatment. And he wasn't just a taxi driver like we have taxi drivers here and, you know, this guy drives for Yellow Cab or whatever.
Right.
In the Belfast of the time, if you were a Catholic and you were going to, you know, pass through a Protestant area on your way to your destination, it wasn't safe for you to do that. You probably wouldn't be able to get a Protestant cab to pick you up.
Right.
Walking
right.
would definitely be unsafe. So if you didn't have a car of your own, you were in a pickle. Ace Taxi arose as a solution to that problem, and it was, you know, a Catholic-owned, unlicensed cab company, and they would come and pick you up, and they would ferry you to wherever you were going safely. Now, once Ace became known to loyalist paramilitaries, of course, they immediately suspected it of being an IRA front, you know, transporting explosives and weapons, you know, across town under the guise of being a taxi service. So the police held a very dim view of Ace Taxi, and if you drove for them, you were going to be stopped on a nightly basis, searched, all the passengers taken out of your car, and so forth. So when Albert Miles was killed, Kevin Barriard was known to the RUC. He was somebody that they didn't like, and his name had been given to them by, I believe, Maurice Gilvary, who was one of the actual killers, who had falsely given up other people before in order to deflect responsibility for killings that he did. He was an IRA man. But after 3 years went by and they didn't have any leads, they didn't have anybody in custody, they didn't know who killed Albert Miles, they picked him up again in 1981, and that was his second trip to Castlereagh for interrogation. And on that occasion, after several days,
they broke him.
And that place was a confession factory. A lot of false confessions came out of Castlereagh, and that's written about somewhat in the book.
Right. Was he beaten?
He was. He would say, you know, he wasn't brutally beaten or beaten for a prolonged period of time, but he was beaten in the abdomen and the head. But I wouldn't say, and I think he wouldn't say, that's what broke him.
Okay, on that then. Well, we're going to stop there, and we'll see what happened after the interrogation. Scott, let's take another break, and we'll come back for the final part of our show tonight.
Today in America, many Christians feel frustrated as they watch their faith being used to further a worldly political agenda. It is as if our religion had been taken hostage, forcibly wedded to a particular political ideology or economic system, or else stripped down to a couple of hot-button issues. Ironically, in our efforts to take back America, we have ourselves been taken captive by the prevailing culture and politics of imperialism, greed, racism, and xenophobia that surrounds us. And so the struggle for the soul of the nation has also become a struggle for the soul of the church. How can we regain a political voice that is neither power-hungry nor passive, neither conservative nor liberal, but simply Christ-like in its concern for justice and the poor. Evangelical pastor S.J. Munson explores these issues in his hard-hitting book, Christ Held Hostage: The Hijacking of American Christianity. What this book has to say will both surprise and challenge you. Available from Amazon in paperback or Kindle.
This is Crime Beat on the Artists First Radio Network. Back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepson.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Dan Lawton, and we're talking about his really interesting book, Above the Law, a true story of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And there's a website, abovethegroundbook.com, where you can catch all kinds of stuff about Dan and the book. And he's not too active on social media. He has a Twitter account, which you can check out. And not too active on Facebook, right, Dan?
Not yet, yeah.
Okay, then, but you're going to tell the people that Wild Blue that you're going to speed it up.
Yes, I owe them that. I owe them a lot, the right. Good people of Wild Blue. They're the best.
Right. There's nothing yet on YouTube that we know of, but you could check it out. You could check out the book or the author on that. So getting back to our discussion, so they break him, and he confesses, and he goes to prison, and he wants to get out, right? He realizes that the only chance he has for freedom is to break out of jail. And so what happened? There's this incredible prison break in 1983, right, out of the Mays, the famous Mays prison in Northern Ireland.
Well, the Mays at the time was the most high-security prison in Europe. It was state-of-the-art, still relatively new, and it housed IRA men, some of whom were, you know, a very accomplished escape artists, among them Jerry Kelly, who had a couple of failed escapes, but also a successful one. And the IRA was not doing well in 1983. You know, the British had killed or imprisoned many of its volunteers. It wasn't winning, you know, the war of public affection or, right. You know, in the audience of public opinion. The Bobby Sands and the other hunger strikers, you know, that was now a couple of years ago. And the British, you know, it didn't really change a lot, frankly, the deaths of the hunger strikers, tragically. So the IRA decided it needed something, and the something was a mass escape from the Mays prison that would be organized in a very meticulous way by people on the inside and on the outside. And over a period of months, they determined that the prior escape attempts, which had mostly involved tunnels, were just doomed to failure from the get-go, because the British always, you know, using ground-penetrating radar, right, and thermal imaging, were able to detect the tunnels. So there had to be a better way. And the way that was thought up by Larry Marley, who was really the architect of this escape, was to get hold of a kitchen truck. There was a kitchen truck that made the rounds of these blocks, H blocks, they were called, every day. Each H block had its own commissary and kitchen, and this food truck drove around and dropped off food. So if they could hijack that truck, take the guards' uniforms, overpower the guards in the H block, get some weapons smuggled in, use them to intimidate the guards, get the guards under control. Then they could load a group of prisoners into the back of this truck and drive out the front gate, and then get off the property, get a few miles away. And then there was a team from South Armagh, an IRA team from South Armagh, who had some heavy weapons and vehicles. And the idea was, at that rally point, the prisoners would be divided up into groups, and they would all speed away, and everybody would get away. And the plan mostly worked up until they got to the front gate, at which point some alert British prison guards who were coming on duty noticed that there was something amiss, and you know, a melee ensued. But Kevin got out in that experience.
With 37 other guys too, right?
And 37 other guys too, and many of them were captured in short order, but right. Five of them.
How did
Arthur
manage to escape? what was different about him?
He had the good luck to stumble on a car that was parked in the guard's parking lot, right. And there was another prisoner, an IRA man named Brendy Mead, who spied the guard, you know, exiting his car, getting ready to come on his shift. Right. And Brendy Mead took that guard's keys, and Kevin Berryart and several other guys piled into this little yellow Toyota Celica and started driving close along the outside wall, which was 18 feet high, and there were snipers up high, but the snipers couldn't get the angle on the car, and the snipers didn't really know what was going on. There was a lot of confusion. There was another guard who saw this car, you know, exiting at high speed and started chasing. You know, in the end, that car smashed into a gate that was just being closed, the very last outer gate. And then most of the occupants, including Kevin Berryart, just ran on foot. And he hid under, you know, some brush. And, you know, British Army had descended pretty quickly, and they had thrown up roadblocks everywhere. And after dark, he spied a housing subdivision that was nearby. He went over there figuring maybe he could hotwire a car or something. He wound up finding a bicycle in a garage and a sweater. It was getting very cold, and he just had a cotton shirt on and a pair of jeans. So he took the sweater and the bike and got on the road to Belfast, and hadn't gotten very far before he ran straight into a roadblock of RUC men who grabbed him and took him to the police station. And he figured, you know, the jig was up. He'd given him a phony name, of course, but he bluffed it out, and they let him go. And, you know, you might say, well, how's that possible? This is all over the airwaves. You know, that doesn't sound like very good work. But part of the escape plan that you asked about included getting access to the prisoners' records and photographs and burning them so that by the time the prison authorities regain control of H7, they wouldn't be able to figure out quickly who had escaped and who hadn't. And all the guys that stayed behind, the rear guard, they all locked themselves in their cells and threw the keys away out the windows.
Oh, wow.
So it took several hours for the British Prison Service to figure out who had escaped, and they didn't have photos that they could publish and say, you know, be on the lookout for this man. He's at large and he's dangerous and so forth. So, to his great good luck, he was within that time window, and they let him go.
Well, what's amazing is he not only escapes and you know, gets free, but he also makes it to America. So how did that happen? I mean, was there some kind of like underground railroad that, you know, that was being used by IRA members to make their way to freedom? What happened?
I think underground railroad is a good term for it, a good loose term for it.
Right.
The IRA definitely helped him, and, you know, one could ask, well, why, you know, if he wasn't in the IRA, then why are they helping him? He was a very last minute addition to the escape, you know, because he had a life sentence, and it was thought that people who had life sentences ought to have first dibs if they wanted to go. But after he got out, he wound up being traveled by the IRA to mainland Europe, Sweden, and he stayed with several other IRA guys. Dermy Finucane was one,
right.
And I don't believe the IRA, you know, the IRA, whatever its various qualities, one of them was not being generous with money. And so when cash arrived to these guys, who were, of course, unemployed and didn't have any money, they still had to pay rent and buy groceries and stuff like that. The cash that was given to Kevin Berryart by the courier had come from his parents and not from the IRA. And they would go around to his parents periodically and say, we need some cash to give to your son. And what they skimmed off, I don't know. Or if they skimmed anything, I don't know.
That's very nice.
but eventually they helped him travel to the United States and get into the United States.
Right. Well, what's amazing is he became a successful car salesman, right? While working in the in the U.S. until he had the trouble with the passport in 92.
Well, this is a guy, Kevin Barriart, that, you know, starting at age 14, worked every day of his life, left high school at age 15, and had a series of jobs and was really good at learning by observation and then by doing. He learned how to repair cars and motorcycles. He learned how to, you know, paint and do carpentry and lay plumbing and all of these things. And he, as I said earlier, he does have a charming personality, and it's a genuineness that, right, that shines through. And that works well in the car sales business. You know, he didn't have a university education. So when he arrived in San Diego with no, you know, college diploma or anything like that, one of the jobs that you could get and actually make good money at was selling cars. And he became the most successful car salesman up to that point at Mossy Ford in Pacific Beach in San Diego. He was selling 20 cars a month.
Did they know who he was?
No, he had taken an alias. The alias was Kevin Cohane, which is spelled K-E-O-H-A-N-E. And everybody thought he was a really happy-go-lucky, you know, gregarious guy named Kevin Cohane. And he obviously came
Irish
from...
Irish immigrant.
You know, was an Irish immigrant who didn't really talk very much about his background, you know, and always managed to steer the conversation in another direction. He was a great friend. He was the guy that, you know, if you had to move, he was going to show up at 6 a.m. and help you move. If you were in trouble or in the hospital, he was the guy that was going to come to the hospital and visit you and be by the side of your bed when you opened your eyes for the first time. So he had some, you know, everybody loved him, really.
Yeah. Did he ever keep in contact with his family back in Northern Ireland?
They said goodbye to each other one night in Donegal. And he reckoned that any kind of communication with them would be detected, would be monitored by the British. And most of all, he wished to never be returned to prison. So he really said goodbye to his entire family. Now, after he got busted and he was in custody over here, one of the first things that we did was to get him on the phone. We would patch the call through my office. He would call my office, collect from the jail. And I remember the first time he got to hear his mom and dad's voice and his ex-wife's voice on the phone in 1992. And so they had a very happy reunion.
We're going to have to cut it short pretty soon because we're almost out of time here on that. But what I'll say is that it has a happy ending, the story. But you'll have to read the book in order to find out what the happy ending is on that. And we congratulate you on the book, Dan. It's really a great read and an amazing story. And we wish you a lot of success with it.
Well, Ron and Scott, thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be on your podcast. 80 million downloads and 636 episodes. You're obviously doing something right. You got a big audience out there that loves you. Yeah. So keep doing it. Keep it up.
Thank you. And thank you for that pep talk. And you have a great evening, Dan.
All right. And, you too, Ron.
And when the movie comes out, you'll be back on. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Good
night.
Good night. That was an amazing hour with Dan Lott talking about his book and Above the Ground. And our next program is scheduled for November 2nd, 2023. We will have Douglas Thompson and Mike Rothweiler discuss their book, Frank Sinatra and the Mafia Murders. We hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Tune in next Thursday, same time, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Sleep tight, everybody.